طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine. We are on Peace and Justice Radio every week to feature the Palestinian perspective through news, commentary, and features that project a narrative rarely portrayed in the mainstream media. What is really happening in Palestine? We address that every week. This is your host, John Roberts. Today we feature Ali Abu Nima, journalist, author, and co-founder of the Electronic Intifada, in conversation with historian, writer, and political activist Barbara Ransby. They discuss Ali Abu Nima's latest book, The Battle for Justice in Palestine. And here are Barbara Ransby and Ali Abu Nima.
It's a little bit of a false advertising to say that we're both going to speak. I'm going to be in conversation with Ali about his new book, which is an amazing contribution in a number of ways. This book, I think, was really important to me as I started reading it, in that it does what I think those of us in the Palestine Solidarity Movement really need to do more of, which is to connect the dots, is to frame the struggle for justice in Palestine in a larger context, in the context of the struggle of oppressed people all over the world. And in Ali's previous book, he compared the struggle in Palestine to struggles in Northern Ireland, struggles in South Africa. In this book, he revisits those two places, but he also brings it closer to home. And I was pleased that you started off with talking about the new Jim Crow and Michelle Alexander's work, which of course builds on the work of Angela Davis and Ruthie Gilmore and many others. And that really talks about comparisons between Israel and the United States as carceral states, and the issue of policing and surveillance that that both of them share. But before we get into the content of the book, by way of introduction, Ali probably really needs no introduction, but Ali Abu Nima is an author of this book and also the book I just mentioned, One Country, but also can be seen and heard routinely on many, many news outlets. It should be many, many more, as a really articulate, passionate voice for justice in Palestine, and one who makes the issue compelling, accessible, relevant to all of us. He is also the founder of the Electronic Intifada. And I must say, when I went on a delegation to Palestine a couple of years ago, I went on a women of color feminist delegation. And when I mentioned, I sort of really tried to get some cred by associating myself with you. When I said Ali Abu Nima and Electronic Intifada, people in the West Bank and throughout occupied Palestine were very impressed. I immediately made friends. So that was all very good. So after that chatty introduction, I wanted to start off asking you to talk about certain aspects of the book. I think it's on the first page you start off and say, the Palestinians are winning. In some ways, that's counterintuitive because we look at the suffering, particularly in Gaza. We look at the complete ignoring of international law by the Israelis, the growth of settlements, and still you make this case that the landscape, the political landscape, is changing, and that's important. And can you say a little bit about that? And then I wanted to kind of go back and talk a little bit about the history and comparisons to other situations in the world.
So I did start with that proposition: the Palestinians are winning. And really, the case I'm trying to make is that Palestinians are winning the argument, because the case for Palestinian rights, and this is the connection I try to make in the book, is the same case for equal rights, for human rights, for anti-racism that we make when we are arguing against mass incarceration or mass deportation. And if you go on any college campus in this country and you make the case, you will get the support of the vast majority of students. And I think that's true in any venue in this country. And that's why it has been so important to try to shut the debate down by Israel and pro-Israel groups, because they know that if we have this discussion, the Palestinians will win, and they will win allies. And that's really the basic premise.
When you compare Palestine and South Africa, you make the point that the struggle in South Africa was not won militarily. ANC, despite the sort of sanitizing of Mandela's history, was an armed struggle. I mean, Umkhonto Wesizwe did fight a military battle, but that's not where the battle was won. The battle was won in terms of delegitimizing the apartheid state, and that's what you argue needs to be our task in terms of confronting Israel at this juncture, what's happening on a lot of college campuses. But I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the history, because I'm a historian, that's one reason. But also, I think you can't enter into this conversation without talking about the history. And it's a kind of really vulgar revisionist history that allows for such a distorted contemporary discussion. And I was particularly struck by the chapter, I think it's chapter 2 or chapter 3, where you say, does Israel have a right to exist as a Jewish state? And then you problematize the notion of Zionism and the notion of a state having the notion of the right to be a Jewish state. What does that mean? How do you enforce that right? Who enforces that right, and at the expense of whom? So can you talk a little bit about how you thought about making that argument around the logic of Zionism?
Well, for me, it came from the fact that Palestinians are constantly lectured that they must first of all recognize Israel, and then secondly recognize Israel as a Jewish state. And this is, you know, a commonplace in media. Barack Obama constantly lectures us that we have to accept Israel's right to exist as a Jewish state. And you might see reported in the New York Times or the Chicago Tribune that Palestinians reject this demand, but you will very rarely, if ever, see a coherent explanation from the perspective of Palestinians, or perhaps other perspectives, of what the problem is with this demand and what impact it has on Palestinians. And what I sought to explain in the chapter, Does Israel Have a Right to Exist as a Jewish State, using, by the way, common Western legal and liberal principles, that a right to exist as a Jewish state translates in practice into a right to discriminate against Palestinians wherever they are. Palestinian refugees who aren't allowed back just because they're not Jewish, Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza who are subjected to a brutal form of apartheid and occupation, and Palestinians who are citizens of Israel but who have constantly a precarious and second-class status simply because they're not Jewish. And to me, the most galling hypocrisy is that this demand is constantly made by liberal intellectuals in the United States who would be appalled if the same demands were made in the American context. And I actually try to create an analogy, to try to give this some way for people in this country to grasp. And so one of the examples I give in that chapter is, imagine if the response to, you know, when people went out during the civil rights movement and they faced dogs and their churches were blown up and people were lynched and people were beaten and people were jailed, and they fought and they died. For what? To end Jim Crow, to end segregation, to win human rights, equal rights. Imagine if the response of the state and the liberal elite had been, well, okay, so you want rights, African Americans want rights, let's create out of, let's say, part of Mississippi, a state of the Negroes. And all African American...
That was argued at one point.
Well, this is the point. This is, and if not outright, you know, expulsion of African Americans. So let's create a state of the Negroes in part of the Mississippi. And if you're African American, your citizenship will be in that state. And if you want to vote, you'll vote in that state. And of course, this is unthinkable in the context of, you know, the American view of itself. But of course, that's what the Bantustans were in South Africa. Of course, there are strong parallels to the reservations which natives were forced onto in this country. But that's precisely what Palestinians are being told is your only option. You must accept a state on a fraction of your land where you will be policed and monitored and fenced. And that's it. That's as high as your aspirations can go. And so I really felt that only by bringing it into the American context could I expose the obscenity of what, first and foremost, not just Israel, but American liberal intelligentsia is demanding of Palestinians.
And I think it does another thing, too, which is it reaches out to natural allies who are other racialized and oppressed people in this country who have suffered a different kind of, I would argue, colonization. You argue in one country the need to get beyond this notion of a two-state solution, and you argue it more forcefully now and really have changed the discourse and changed a lot of our thinking, I think, on this question. And I think it's not surprising that many, even conservative Israelis, are saying a two-state solution is an option. But the kind of state, of course, in terms of borders, in terms of refugees, in terms of Jerusalem, in terms of the settlements, is what is critical to that debate. So you say that a binational state already exists, but it's an apartheid state. And you've said a little bit about why that's true. But can you speak to the issues of settlement and the so-called peace talks and the frame and paradigm of what is envisioned as a viable Palestinian state, which in fact would not be something most Palestinians would accept or be happy with? Say something about that.
Well, right now, supposedly, you know, in the next few weeks, the latest iteration of the peace process under the sponsorship of Secretary of State John Kerry is supposed to end at the end of April. And they were supposed to come up with an agreement. And then they downgraded it to something they called a framework agreement, where it's not going to be a final agreement, but they're going to agree sort of the broad outlines, and then, you know, that will then be turned into a permanent agreement. Right now, the common wisdom is that there's absolutely no agreement on anything. The basic premises, you know, they're so far apart. Over Israel's demand that it be recognized as a Jewish state and therefore have a right to discriminate against Palestinians and expel them if necessary. Because the point I make is that for there to be a right, you have to be able to enforce that right. So if Israel has a right to exist as a Jewish state and Palestinians become too numerous simply by reproducing, then they're violating Israel's right to exist by existing.
And having babies.
And therefore, Israel would be well within its right, in order to protect its right to exist as a Jewish state, to expel Palestinians, to limit their civil rights, and so on. And to me, this is states' rights. I mean, that was the argument, right? You know, states' rights is what Israel is arguing for. So, but this is now what, you know, John Kerry and Barack Obama are telling Palestinians they have to accept. Even Mahmoud Abbas, who I would describe as, you know, the head of a puppet regime under occupation, cannot accept it. So people will, I mean, I don't know what they'll do at the end of April. I don't think they're going to declare, okay, it's finished, it's over. That's too scary. The show has to keep going on. The sham has to keep going on. And so they might say, well, we're going to extend it for another 6 months, another 6 years, another 20 years. The point is what is happening on the ground in the meantime is that Israel continues to take land, to colonize land. The situation Gaza, and I was able to get to Gaza for the first time last May, it's hard to describe the thousand little ways and big ways that people in Gaza are being systematically stripped of everything that makes life bearable and society sustainable. Israel's siege and the fencing of Gaza is an attack on the sustainability of society. It's about breaking down a society. And it's just impossible to talk about a two-state solution with these realities. It's fantasy. You know, when they talk about borders, final state, it's a fantasy when you compare it to what is actually happening.
I think one of the compelling, uplifting aspects of your argument is that despite all of what's gone on, that you're hopeful that people could live together. You talk about Ireland and you talk about South Africa, because I think the notion is that this is untenable, you know, that there's been so much bloodshed and so forth and so on. And, as a historian, I think often the most uplifting thing about history is to look at how much things change in ways that we don't foresee and what capacity human beings have to change. The politicians, which we'll talk about in a minute, have a particular agenda and have done some pretty corrupt things. But ordinary people, there is a potential for the one state that you advocate.
Well, you used a word earlier, which I also use in the book, and I think is a very
useful... That's probably where I got it from.
Well, no, you've used it before for sure, which is decolonization. And I think the framework of thinking about the relationship between Palestinians and Israelis as a colonial relationship is, to me, the best framework for describing the situation, settler colonialism. And so then the problem becomes about not making peace between two sides and using the language of false parity that is inherent in the peace process, but decolonizing and dismantling structures of oppression and replacing them with relationships that are based on equality, restitution, respect. And those things are incredibly difficult. And that's where I do point to South Africa 20 years after the end of apartheid, where it's far from all roses. The point of my discussion of South Africa is to say that decolonization is actually extremely difficult. And that's what the new Jim Crow is. It's a failure of decolonization. It wasn't enough to pass laws saying everyone is equal now. In practice, oppression and injustice and inequality are very adaptable. So where I did find hope, and one example that I explored was in Northern Ireland, where the story that has been told, and this to me was very similar to Palestine, is that, this was an ancient conflict, a religious conflict. And what I found so interesting in Ireland, and I know that we have friends here who've worked in solidarity in Ireland for many decades, and they're going to hate me for... Maybe not hate me, but they might. They're going to raise an eyebrow, but I'm going to read the book.
Don't make eye contact.
All right. Well, no, I am right now. But read the book. Because I use the example of Ian Paisley, who is viewed by Irish nationalists as one of the most despicable figures in the history of the struggle in Ireland. But he was very adept after the Belfast Agreement at rewriting history and changing the story that he told himself and everyone else, where he had spoken in the most really vile sectarian terms against Catholic people. He now started to speak in a language of a shared history, and it's very interesting when you look at his speeches, how quickly he simply threw overboard the sectarian language he'd been using for decades. And the example that
De Klerk in South Africa does the same thing.
It does the same thing. And I found it so interesting because we're often told in the context of Palestine is people can never overcome, and especially Israelis, we're told, can never overcome their viewpoints. And the point I wanted to make is that when power starts to shift and people can no longer justify or defend their supremacy, then they can rewrite history with incredible speed in order to adapt to a new reality. So I wanted to provide examples of that that people could touch to say that this actually happens now.
Mm-hmm. To complicate that a little bit, and you, I was glad that you did this in the book, a lot of times when comparing apartheid policies in Israel with apartheid South Africa, people sort of suggest that things were resolved in South Africa, things have, you know, resolved positively. And of course, we you know, that was an issue and a struggle very close to my heart for many years. And we are glad that apartheid was defeated. But of course, the reality now is enormous economic suffering, emerging new elites. And you talk about that, and you talk about it in the context of a very harsh critique of Mahmoud Abbas and the PA. So I think in each and every situation of decolonization, there is the sort of comprador elites, the elites who become the neo-colonialists in many places. And the groundwork for that gets set in the process, in the struggle for decolonization. And, you know, I think it is astute and important to understand in the context of Palestine now. There are Palestinian elites, and there are people who in some ways, you know, resting on the realities and contradictions of Oslo, maybe not contradictions, resting on the unfortunate realities of what Oslo put in place, policing Palestinians and setting terms that could compromise a more just outcome in the end, which you argue has to be a demand for economic justice as well as democracy, political democracy. And I think that's really important, and it's one of the lessons from South Africa in addition to the inspiration in South Africa. I don't know if you want to say anything more about that.
Yes, the critique of South Africa is that, you know, the ANC traded political power, I mean, gained political power and ended political apartheid, but the white elite maintained economic control, and that's a valid critique. I think the innovation in Palestine, or where Palestine has been a pioneer, is in doing that without achieving even political rights or liberation. And that people say, well, if there were a one-state solution, or if there were a two-state solution, then there would be, you know, this terrible economic reality as happened in South Africa. And what I'm saying in the book is you don't need to wait. It's already here. It's already there. And the question is, how do you resist it, and how do you create alternatives to it? And I talk about one example that, you know, to me has just been really eye-opening. In, you know, in the past few years, you've had Thomas Friedman, and you've had other American media figures going to the West Bank and declaring that there's an economic miracle, that Palestine is booming and that the foundations of a state are being built. And this is all, it was a massive hoax. What they were seeing, and I think they knew that this is what they were seeing, was a small elite, you know, living large on aid money, on trade, on easy credit, while the vast majority of Palestinians were getting poorer, mass unemployment was growing. And a symbol I talk about in the book of this really dystopian reality is something called Rawabi, which was advertised and marketed in dozens of stories in the U.S. and global media as the first planned Palestinian city and as the cornerstone of a Palestinian state. And, you know, this isn't this fantastic? It's going to be affordable housing for Palestinians. Turns out Rawabi is a luxury real estate development financed by Qatar, completely the brainchild of a single Palestinian billionaire, built on land expropriated from Palestinian villages using some of the same methods that the Israelis use, displacing poor farmers, or at least taking land that they could use, and replacing them with a, you know, upper class, wealthy, salaried elite living as nuclear families in this sort of westernized lifestyle. And Rawabi itself is actually architecturally modeled after an Israeli settlement. I mean, it's the first, not the first Palestinian planned city, but the first Palestinian-Israeli settlement. And to me, it symbolizes really the horrifying future that awaits Palestinians if they don't wake up to this, and it places Palestine in the context of global neoliberalism. That South Africans were, you know, the free South Africa was born into an unfree neoliberal world. The same world that makes, you know, we have record numbers of billionaires and record numbers of people, you know, living in poverty and unemployment. It's the same processes, and so we have to place Palestine back into that context.
And you quote Naomi Klein and the shock doctrine as a way to also understand this neoliberal policies of tax breaks for companies, including capitalists from outside of Palestine who come in into the West Bank area with the consent of the PA and the Israelis and do these projects, but are giving nothing back and therefore creating increased wealth disparity in that context.
It's horrifying what the World Bank has visioned for Palestine is being implemented now, is to turn it, you know, to create these so-called industrial zones or economic zones. I mean, these are like the maquiladoras in Mexico. They're like, you know, they're zones where there is no law. Only the company that controls them controls. I mean, in Palestine, this has already happened. So the Palestinian Authority signed an agreement with to create something called the Al-Jalameh Industrial Zone near Jenin in the north. And they have given a concession to a Turkish company for 49 years. And they signed an agreement. It was a secret agreement, but we actually got a copy of it, that says the company has total control. Nobody can come in, not even the Palestinian Authority. No government officials can come in. The company can set up its own security force. And the irony is, this Turkish company that will run this zone has more sovereignty and control than the Palestinian Authority. And while this agreement guarantees the rights of the company, it's totally silent on the rights of workers, on the rights of the, you know, on environmental protection, on regulation of anything to do with human beings. It exempts the company. It says that all foreign workers are exempt from taxes. So it actually creates an incentive to bring foreign workers in and not to employ Palestinians. And then if you manufacture in the zone, you export to the world without paying tariffs. Whereas if you're a Palestinian company employing Palestinians, you have to pay taxes on your workers and then you have to pay tariffs. So it's about actually destroying any sustainable indigenous economic base. And the World Bank, and I quote them in the book, says this is, you know, they put this forward as a bright future for Palestine, where the industrial zones will be a place for Israeli companies to benefit from lower production costs and to export to the Arab world, to be a gateway to the Arab world. And the Palestinian Authority has signed these agreements. And you only have to look next door to Jordan how this has worked out. Because in Jordan, after the peace treaty that Israel signed with Jordan in 1994, they set up similar zones, and they were advertised with all the same rhetoric of peace, peace dividends, and, you know, economy for peace, and all this lovely talk. And today, even the Jordanian government acknowledges that more than two-thirds, in some cases 80% of the workers other countries, usually China and South Asia. There have been horrifying abuses that are documented, talking about people being forced to work 96-hour weeks for 44 cents an hour, people being beaten and abused for trying to organize or escape, sexual assaults. And these are foreign companies that are coming in, bringing foreign workers, no accountability, no law. And I'm not saying that that's what is planned, that anyone intends to happen. Nobody intended that to happen in Jordan. But that's what happened, and there is nothing to prevent this from happening in Palestine.
Well, I actually want to ask you, I want to shift to your discussion of BDS, which is a movement in solidarity that's called for by Palestinian civil society and so forth. But, you know, in describing the already existing reality of neoliberalism, in the cautionary tale of other situations of decolonization that has led to less than ideal outcomes, you know, I think a question that I always think here is, what forces do I support in Palestine? I mean, what are, in my terms, sort of what are the progressive or left forces? And of course, you know, I support BDS, and I think another interesting comparison to the anti-apartheid struggle is, of course, Omar Barghouti, who has been the voice of that struggle in Palestine, was at Columbia at the height of the anti-apartheid movement, supported it, learned from it. So there are concrete personal connections of camaraderie, I think, that exist that we sometimes forget about. But from a distance, I mean, what would you say in terms of forces on the ground emerging in Palestine, other than the civil society organizations, perhaps, that represent a real alternative to the PA and people who are prepared to go along with the neoliberal agenda?
That's hard for me to answer. And I think that, I was only in Gaza for a week, but I didn't sleep very much when I was there. So we managed to get 2 weeks out of it. During that time, I met so many people. And the thing that, you know, there's incredible frustration with the official political structures, and they're seen as failing, having failed to offer a vision and a strategy that people can pursue. And even when you talk to people in these movements in Gaza, which I did, and all the brand name political factions in Palestine, they'll tell you the same thing. They say, we failed to offer this vision. And there are so many factors that, in a sense, suppress the emergence of alternatives on a large scale, let's say. And so it's very hard for me to predict or to say how this will happen, but people are working. They're often working, you know, outside the formal structures. I think one of the things that still unites Palestinians is solidarity and struggle for political prisoners. And there are still thousands of Palestinian political prisoners. And that's something that cuts across all political divisions in Palestine. I think that in a sense, what happens in Palestine, what happens outside Palestine, affect each other. And again, this is something that when you talk to people in Gaza or other places, and they see that there is solidarity work that is having an impact, it gives people some motivation or some sense that the work they do is worthwhile doing, and vice versa, because we take inspiration when we see people going out every Friday, no matter what, and facing the tear gas and facing the bullets. We say, well, we can do no less in terms of the work we do. So I don't know how that will evolve. And in a sense, I'm not so worried about it. I thought I was going to spend more time in the book on that than I ended up doing, because I really feel that what we can do now is that, you know, the BDS movement, boycott, divestment, and sanctions, is, you could say there are all kinds of shortcomings or difficulties or questions about it, that would be fine. But it is the most successful movement I've seen in my lifetime to mobilize people in practical ways to build support for the rights of all Palestinians and for all Palestinian rights. And it also contains, because it is based on clear universal principles, it also is open and encourages the kinds of alliances we were talking about earlier. And in very practical ways, let me just give one example. Many boycott, divestment, sanctions campaigns have been aimed at a company called G4S. This is a huge international prison and security, they call themselves security company, which provides equipment to Israeli interrogation centers like Al Jalameh, where Palestinian children are routinely tortured and held in solitary confinement. But it is also a company that runs, that's one of the largest providers of prisons in this country. So there is a BDS campaign. There's nothing to stop people from building a campaign around that. And some of the most successful campaigns, like campaigns against Veolia, an occupation profiteer, they were kicked out of St. Louis, Missouri. The city of St. Louis was forced to end a contract with Veolia because Palestine Solidarity activists worked with environmental activists who were concerned about Veolia. They worked with labor activists. So the BDS movement is not an isolated thing that's just about Palestine, but it opens doors to building that broader solidarity that I think is essential if we're going to win.
One of the things that's happening on college campuses is in places that I've been to recently, is that Students for Justice in Palestine are linking with students who are involved in prison divest campaigns and pointing out some of the links, both linking in terms of the tactic of divestment to put pressure on the university and expose certain contradictions, but also, you know, linking the fact that it's prisons here, it's an open prison there, as well as prisons there, and many political prisoners there and still here too, which we don't talk about enough. You talk about BDS and the struggle on campuses, and I think probably evidence of the fact that BDS as a strategy is shifting the discourse, is putting defenders of Israeli policy on the defensive, is this whole rebranding campaign on the part of the Israeli government to really attack people who stand up for BDS. I happen to be a member of the American Studies Association, and the leaders of that organization have been harassed, and my name was associated with it, so I've gotten probably not as many harassing phone calls as you have, but harassing phone calls and the like, and this sort of intimidation campaign against people who will support BDS using academic freedom.
Nobody calls me. They know I'm beyond hope.
But, you know, anyway, but I think the way that the aggressive response on the part of pro-Israeli forces is evidence that this tactic has enormous weight and potential. I mean, even the pinkwashing and the greenwashing to make Israel look more democratic, more progressive, et cetera. So why don't you talk about pinkwashing and greenwashing a little bit, but more importantly maybe to talk about what you see as being at stake in the struggles on campuses.
Well, I quote in the book an organization called the David Project, yeah, which is a multi-million-dollar organization founded by Charles Jacobs, a virulently Islamophobic, extreme right-wing supporter of Israel. And their mandate, so to speak, is to suppress academic inquiry about Palestine, Israel on campus, and to suppress Palestine solidarity activism. And I quote a white paper that they published in 2012 where they say that the future of U.S.-Israeli relations and the future of U.S. support for Israel will be decided on campuses. And if they lose the battle on campuses to maintain support for Israel, then that's it. They're done. And this explains why they are putting not just the David Project, but a whole range of pro-Israel organizations are putting fantastic amounts of money and effort into a whole range of activities that, you know, it's like a carrot and a stick. The carrot is to try to brand Israel as this progressive, liberal haven, a villa in the jungle, as one Israeli prime minister put it, using a very racist and colonial imagery, of course. And on the other hand, a very aggressive campaign targeting teachers, targeting faculty, targeting the American Studies Association. And we've now reached the point of outright censorship. And this is very real. We have a free speech emergency in this country when it comes to the freedom to think and speak about Palestine. A few days ago at Northeastern University in Boston, as far as I know, this is the first time this has happened in the United States. It's happened in Canada, but as we know, Canada are socialists, and so they, you know, they don't believe in freedom like America. The first time it's happened in the United States that a university banned a Students for Justice in Palestine organization outright on the most bogus grounds. In fact, the grounds were that the students had distributed flyers critical of Israel. And I wrote about this on the Electronic Intifada, and there's been a big mobilization around it. But this is one example of a really disturbing trend. Of course, we've seen now a slew of legislation. Yeah. In Illinois, there was a bill. In Maryland, in New York, to penalize, and this was spurred by the decision of the American Studies Association to endorse the Palestinian call for the academic boycott of Israeli institutions complicit in Israel's human rights abuses. So these bills, they're very similar, demand that states or the federal government, because there's now a bill in Congress introduced by two Illinois, mm-hmm. a bipartisan bill, mm-hmm. I don't know the names of any Illinois members of Congress. They're so irrelevant to my life, I don't know their names. But one Republican, one Democrat, introduced a bill in Congress that would require the federal government to penalize by withholding funds any academic institution if a significant body like a department or an academic association even makes a statement in support of boycott. So penalizing people for their opinions, this is the point we've reached.
Well, preventing state institutions from supporting faculty who want to go to conferences
right.
of
exactly.
these organizations.
Exactly. Yeah. So financial and other sanctions if you think wrong thoughts about Israel. Mm. So we have a political class in this country that is prepared to sacrifice the most fundamental rights, First Amendment rights, for the sake of suppressing criticism of Israel. And what we're seeing in this country is a revolt against that. You know, and it's we're seeing it among students. I was at the University of Michigan last night. It was one of the most incredible things I've seen. Students there brought a divestment bill to the student government. And these student divestment bills, they're symbolic in the sense that they're calling on the university to divest. They themselves don't control the university's portfolio. The student government, now I know where the, I don't want to use an expletive, who are now in Congress come from. They're trained in the university student governments. But they, basically voted to postpone the bill indefinitely. But there were hundreds of people there, and some of the student reps were saying, wait a minute, we're going to ignore the fact that this is the largest number of people that have ever come to a student government meeting in history. They had to move it to the grand ballroom in the Michigan Union because there were hundreds of people there. And you're saying that we're going to just sideline the question. So there's a revolt against it. And the revolt is also among faculty who are speaking out against university presidents. In the olden days, university presidents were members of faculty who defended the rights of faculty. They were elected from the faculty. Today, university presidents are CEOs who cater to donors and corporate sponsors of the university. So we're seeing faculty having to stand up to the CEOs. We should not call them university presidents. Let's call them what they are, CEOs.
I think what you... I was at Michigan about 2 weeks ago, and a group of anti-racist students, United Coalition for Racial Justice, had a 1,000-person teach-in, and one of the groups there were... It's not Students for Justice in Palestine. It has another name, but the...
SAFE, Students Allowed for Freedom and Equality.
Right. Were a major contingent in that. And I think that speaks to, and kind of want... I want to bring it full circle to where you begin the book in talking about the issue of mass incarceration. I think in some ways young people on campuses and young people in communities also are offering an example of the kind of multi-issue coalition work. We call it, in Ella's Daughters, we call it political quilting, that we need to do in terms of building a progressive movement that would be in solidarity with justice in Palestine, but also would link that struggle to the struggle right outside our door. One thing I, when I became more aware of the issue of Palestine is really through the anti-apartheid movement. And it was in the context of learning about struggles for justice and against colonialism all over the world. And Palestine was a struggle that had to be included when you invited speakers on campus and so forth. And I think we need to re-embrace that. But more recently, I've said, you know, wherever I go to speak, I raise the issue of Palestine. And I think what I also want to see happen more among, you know, all of us is that in the Palestinian struggle, I think you do this, but it's not always done, you know, is to link with the issue of mass incarceration here, to link Palestine with other anti-racist struggles. You argue that, you know, defending Israel's right to exist is to acknowledge the racism toward the Palestinians, which is, you know, incorporated into Israeli policy so integrally. So it's an anti-racist issue, it's an anti-colonial issue, and I think we also have to link that to the crisis in urban communities among Black and Latino youth in this country, you know, who I remember when my partner Peter first went to the occupied territory, he was struck by the treatment of Palestinian youth on the streets by police in the way that Black and Latino youth are treated here. So I think making those connections in the way that the prison divest and the BDS students are making on college campuses is really our challenge to, you know, to make the issue of justice in Palestine an issue of all progressive movements, and to ask a Palestinian activist to also make, you know, the larger progressive agenda for a different kind of society, you know, a part of every conversation that we have about Palestine. And I think your book helps us and encourages and provokes us to do that. So thank you for it.
Thank you. And I'll just say that I learned so much in writing it, and I know I left a lot out. You know, for me, it was a beginning. It was the process of making those connections. And that's work that I want to continue to do.
That was Barbara Ransby, professor of history at University of Illinois, Chicago, in conversation with Ali Abu Nima about his book, The Battle for Justice in Palestine. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m., You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.